You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the next off-season podcast. I'm your host, Aaron Armstrong, and I am here today to talk to you about more Big Brother. Of course, because again, Big Brother has more data, and data is going to be important for this one, especially because today we're going to be talking about something that has been debated about Big Brother for ages, for a long time. The common wisdom was to go one way, and then it went a different way. And now people don't know. And so we're going to answer the question. And the question is, you get cast for Big Brother. You get on stage. Julie sends you into the house. You're meeting a bunch of new people. You're very scared. You don't know what to do. And then Julie says, all right, everybody to the backyard. It's time for the first HOH competition. You get outside. You look at the competition. You go, oh man, I think... Could I win this one? I think I could maybe win this one. Should I win this one? That's what we want to answer. The first HOH. What does it do for you? Should you win? Should you not win? If you do, what should you do? How successful are people who win the first HOH in the game? How long do they tend to last? What are some of the important variables to determine your success in the game? We're going to be talking about all things first HOH today, and hopefully all of your questions will be answered. That's impossible. Probably like 10% of them, but it's a big 10%, right? So this one is going to be a little bit different. I have a guest to come on with me, and she's going to talk about some data stuff. And then I'm going to afterwards, sort of try to analyze and contextualize the data as much as I can based on my own sort of knowledge of the show and the game and the history, to try and piece it all together, package it all together for you. And at the end of the podcast, I want to tell you, like, what is the perfect first HOH reign, right? Like, what should we be doing? And also, should you even win? And so that's what we want to do. There are a few things that I want to look into here. You know, obviously, should you win the first HOH? Should you win the veto if you have won the first HOH? How important is it that you have a target, that you get your target out in the first HOH? How important are alliances as the first HOH? All of these questions I want to address, I want to look at as variables in terms of like how well people have done in the past and how well people might do moving forward. How has the era of Big Brother changed this? How does the development of alliance structure change this? All things I want to get into in this podcast. So stay tuned, and we're going to have some fun. All right. So I have brought on with me here a data wizard, I believe is the appropriate term, Christina, who has long helped me with things like the stock watch and the legacy watch and all kinds of data analysis. And so when I was thinking about, you know, wanting to do deep dives into specific corners of Big Brother social strategy in general, I thought of, you know, we like to talk about this stuff like we know what we're talking about. But, you know, you always kind of think, well, what does the data say? And most of the time, the data says there's not enough data. but I'll have Christina help explain that. Christina, how are you doing?
I'm great. How are you? Wow, data wizard. Never thought I'd hear that one. I might have to add that to my resume after this is over.
I mean, is it not already on your resume?
I need to add it, clearly.
So Christina, tell the people what it is that you do, why you're qualified to, why you truly are a wizard here.
Okay, sure. So in real life, I am my official title at work is like, I'm a BI and analytics developer for a sports technology company. And I focus on like baseball analytics, actually. So that all that means is like, mostly I create reports that analyze player performance, and I also do some machine learning. So it's just like building statistical models, making predictions based on data. And so I've also been a reality TV fan for a really, really long time. I've been watching Survivor since I was like 9 or 10 years old. More recently got into Big Brother. So I do kind of have a background in analytics. And so that kind of obviously does help me with like the kind of projects that we do that have to do with data analysis.
But I think it's also important to note that that, as I sort of mentioned a little bit when I introduced you, but there's the Big Brother and data are not really they don't cohabitate very well because there's not a lot of it. There's been only 20 so seasons of Big Brother US, and every season is different and every cast is different, and all the inputs into this sort of analysis can be subjective. It's a very difficult thing to really nail down. And so, everything that we say here, as with all analysis, should be taken with a grain of salt. Just because it's data doesn't mean it's suddenly, infallible or anything like that. I know Christina is very detailed, and she's used to working with things that make actual sense, not just Big Brother. I know that she is very much in the team of like this is just for fun. Please don't tell me that I did something wrong, because I know it's wrong.
Like for me, like professionally, just like looking at baseball, it's very, very different from reality TV. Like, baseball has been played professionally for over 100 years. Like, every season there are at least like over 2,000 games. When you're doing an analysis on that kind of data, we can be confident that we have like a sample size that's like big and robust enough to be like perform an analysis on and like draw like actual conclusions from it. Like Taryn said, like reality TV as we know it has only really been around for 20 years. There's a much smaller sample size to draw from. So like, as your sample size goes up, you tend to be like more confident in the estimates that you're making about like your means or percentages and stuff. But when we're working with a sample size that's like this small, like 20 individuals, really, each individual point kind of like influences the estimates that you're making a lot more. So the fact that there's like such a small sample size for reality TV does make it a little harder to make meaningful conclusions, but we're going to do our best here with what we have today.
Yeah, and I think like a good example of it is Jesse's first HOH win in season 11, where he is a first HOH, and should have, was set up to do really well in the game, but this random kind of way overpowered twist called the coup d'etat took him out of the game, it's hard to really quantify that data wise, right? Like, it's hard to really, go like, oh, well, this happened, but it was only because of this. Because that kind of skews, that's so subjective, it skews the data. But that one point on the graph is very influential. And that's why that sort of thing can it's why this data is, take it with a grain of salt.
Right. Like, not to bring it back to baseball, but baseball has very, very consistent rules that have like stayed constant for, again, over 100 years. Like, with reality TV, it's not as the structure isn't as sound. Like, it's entertainment at the end of the day. So generally, like, the rules and the format are changed up a lot to keep it interesting, but it's also a little bit harder to really analyze when it's not consistent.
Mm-hmm. So Christina, you went through all of these points. You've done so much work on this dumb project. please tell me what were some of the things that you found about winning the first HOH and how it connects to potential success in the game?
Sure. If we go to variables that are most associated with longevity in the game, and actually, before we talk about that, I do want to kind of define what I mean by longevity a little bit. So when we say longevity, all we mean is how far the person went in the game, how far they lasted. It has nothing to do with win equity. We don't care like how much of a chance they really had at winning when they got to the end. It's just how many days or how many rounds they survive. So the way I kind of went about doing that was I looked at all BBUS seasons, but also Big Brother Canada seasons, and I kind of had some criteria to kind of eliminate or to focus on like what individuals we were looking at, right? So the first thing was like that a season, it must be regular length season. So I didn't include Celebrity Big Brother or BBOTT. The season also must have been played to completion. So as much as I would have loved for the brain transformation specialist himself to be part of this analysis, unfortunately, he did not qualify. And the season just could not just don't be BB9. So I think we kind of agreed that the couple of rounds of that season, like the first two eliminations, weren't really representative of like how normal seasons tend to go with people being in pairs. And also there was a first, the first round was like you cast a soul vote to evict.
Was Big Brother 9. Just we just pretend it doesn't exist.
Yeah, we're working real hard here to erase BB9 from the Big Brother canon. But yeah, so those are kind of the assumptions I kind of was working off of in order to narrow down just which individuals we're going to be looking at. Again, when we're talking about longevity, mostly I'm going to be talking about it in terms of like total number of days survived. And obviously, going back to what we were talking about of like how variable a lot of seasons are. Each season in Big Brother history has like a different number of days. So some are shorter than others. So we're going to be talking about it as a percentage, just in order to keep everything kind of on the same wavelength. So if we go onto variables most associated with longevity, one of the most important variables in differentiating the first HOHs that go the distance versus those who get voted out early is just being successful in getting your target out. So there's a huge difference in the distributions of longevity between the first HOHs who were able to get their target evicted versus those who were not. So if you were to visualize this with like box plots or something, there's no overlap at all and no real outliers, especially when you're looking at just US HOHs. So just to kind of give you an example of this. So in BBUS, the longest any first HOH went in the game after failing to evict their target was Mike Boogie. At 40%. So he lasted 33 of 82 days. The absolute shortest any first HOH went in the game after succeeding in evicting their target was Nathan at 49%. So he lasted 40 of 82 days. So there's no overlap there. You have Mike Boogie, who's the best out of everyone who failed to evict their HOH, and Nathan, who is the worst at everyone who succeeded in evicting their HOH, and there's a space there. And so this trend is actually kind of maintained when you add Big Brother Canada to the equation. So like you have Suzette and Levita, who both failed to get their targets out. And they lasted a little longer than Mike Boogie, but they lasted shorter than everyone who succeeded in getting their targets out, with the exception of maybe like Kale. But yeah, everyone in Big Brother Canada who was successful in evicting their target lasted at least 70% of the way through the game. And this makes sense because like if your target is evicted, that means a majority of people voted with you or for your cause, or they were willing to do your bidding. So you probably had to form some relationships along the way. And that means there's probably a higher likelihood that the next HOH will be someone who voted with you. So you have a high chance of being safe for the next round, and you'll have time for any hard feelings about that first vote to wear off.
Yeah. And I think something to note even about Mike Boogie himself is that, you know, it was easier to survive a longer percentage of his game because his game was a lot shorter. And, you know, he only really survives two rounds, before he gets convicted, after he fails. So, it really is. And even if we talk about, you know, Nathan famously, is going to, be in a pretty decent spot, you know, in season four, and then he blows it up by using the veto on Allison after being, seduced into doing so, when it's really not in his best interest. And that's what really, kills his game. But even as you said, like he still makes it, you know, much further in the game and certainly had more win equity than Boogie did. If we're going by my, you know, in unscientific analysis.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So a big takeaway there is, if you're going to win the first HOH, you better find a way to get your target out, clearly. So I guess we can go into a little bit of some demographic information here. So when you're looking at doing any kind of analysis, I think it's important generally to like look at like the underlying demographics of your individuals, because things like gender or like age can also kind of be a little bit of an important factor in influencing trends and stuff. So if we're looking at gender, men have won the first HOH about 64% of the time, whereas women have won the first HOH about 36% of the time. But if we're treating like the first 21 seasons as like a sample of like the total possible outcomes of like the first HOH and like all the possible ways a future season can play out, there isn't enough evidence to say that like men win the first HOH a disproportionate amount of the time. So if you were to do like a statistical test, we call it like a chi-square test, you can compare like the proportion of your sample to like the expected proportion. And the test tells you whether there's like a significant difference, like statistically. So basically it's just saying like, all right, the sample that you have, are we confident that any differences between the sample and your greater population are not due to chance? So here, there isn't enough evidence to say that the difference is not due to chance. So yeah, so whereas like historically men have won more, we can't conclude that this is due to any like kind of gender bias. And like, I think it would be a little bit more illuminating if we did have more data. Yeah, so men do tend to win more, but not like statistically significantly more. One interesting tidbit of information that I do want to bring up is that women in Big Brother US, women have been successful 100% of the time in getting their targets out, while men have only been about 70% successful. So if you're going to look at like longevity between men and women, that difference would likely account for any differences that you'd see if you compare them. If you just looked at the HOHs who are successful in getting their targets out, the median longevities are about the same. So there aren't really like a ton of differences in terms of like how men and women perform.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's you know, when we look at there, we have four first HOH winners that went on to win their season. Nicole, Rachel, Lisa, and Hayden.
Right.
So three of the four first HOHs to win the game are, in fact, women. And women have won less games overall than men. So you would expect that number to be a little different, right?
Right. I think it's more that like, right. So you have most have won the game in terms of, I guess, if you're looking at who are women. But I think you also have a fair amount of finalists or people who went far in the game that are men. So like, that's not counting what you just stated, was not counting like people like Tyler or McCray or like Beast Mode Cowboy or like Adam Pike or people who went a very long way. Like longevity isn't just about winning the game. It's about like how far you lasted. So someone who's a finalist, is going to have the same longevity as somebody who won. Yeah, if you kind of look at the spread, it's really not that different.
Yeah.
So then if we were going to look at age, so I took a bit of a different approach with looking at age. So as we know, the age, of casting on Big Brother is very skewed. So like if I said that 62% of players who won the first HOH were in their 20s, which I believe is true, by the way, that wouldn't mean that much because most of the people cast on the show are in their 20s. And this distribution of ages changes from season to season. So it's a little bit of a different concept than gender because every season, with like only maybe like a couple of exceptions, start out with half men and half women. But not every season has the same ratio of like people in their 20s to people in their 30s and so on. And there's also the fact that you could be like 25 years old on one season and be in the bottom half of the cast age wise. But then on another season, depending on how it's cast, you could be in the older half of the season age wise. And that's also kind of not to mention that like when you're playing exclusively against the people on your season, where you are relative to everyone else is the only thing that matters, right? It doesn't matter where you are against like the entire population of Big Brother players. It really just matters that the people who are on your season. So what I did to kind of get around this is I kind of calculated the median age of contestants for each season. If you're not familiar with like measures of central tendency, like median, median is just the middle number of like a spread of numbers. So what it does is it divides your data set by like 50% pieces. So the median, the numbers above the median are like the top 50% of your data. The numbers below your median are the bottom 50% of your data. So I assigned each first HOH to being in the older half of their season or in the younger half of their season. And so, again, this is a bit of a sample size issue. There's no statistical significance here, but contestants in the younger half of ages have historically won more often in BBUS. So I believe it's 15 versus 7. But if you were to add Big Brother Canada to that and then take out the seasons that we were going to get rid of because they didn't qualify, it is split almost down the middle. So if we were to look at success based on age group, so the upper 50% of ages group failed to evict their target 38.5% of the time, whereas the lower 50% group or the younger group failed to evict their target about 14% of the time. So that is probably what accounts for the fact that while there is a fair amount of overlap in the distributions, the medians are pretty different. So median longevity for the upper group is about 50%, whereas median for the lower group is around 93%, which is a lot. So, and so this is kind of like going back to like what I was talking about earlier, where target fate is really like the most important variable, when we're considering, first HOH longevity. So because the older players are less successful in evicting their target, generally that could be thought of as the explanation for why they don't last as long in the game. But if we were to isolate only players who did succeed in evicting their target, the older group median is still lower. So the median there is 75% compared to the younger group median of 93%. So if you add Big Brother Canada to that, the median actually drops down to 68% for the older group. And so this is a pretty crazy finding for the younger group because basically what that means is that if you're saying that the median for that group is 93%, that means that half of contestants in the younger half of their cast who won the first HOH made it at least 93% of the way through the game. And so depending on when you play, that means you either place third or fourth at least. So younger players who win the first HOH have consistently had a lot of success, whereas the success of the older players is a little bit more spread out.
Yeah, so just to restate that for my own making sure I understand it. Yeah. If you are one of the in the younger half of your cast, if you are one of the younger players on your cast, mm-hmm. you win the first HOH and you successfully take out your target, you are not on the wrong side of that first vote, mm-hmm. then you have a very good chance of making it very far. And the 50% of the people who meet that criteria end up in the final four, final three at least.
Right, exactly. Yep.
So that's pretty significant if you're going to be a younger player on the show, I think.
Yeah, no, for sure. If you want me to kind of read real quick, just examples of people who fall into these groups that we talked about. So if we're talking about the people who have gone really far that fall into that younger age group, we have Tyler, we have Rachel Riley, we have Nicole, we have Lisa, we have Hayden, McRae, all people who have made it really, really far. Janelle. In terms of people who didn't make it as far and kind of fall below that median that are in that age group, we have Caleb. We have Adam Pike from Big Brother Canada, and both of those guys still made it really far in the game. And then we have Christy, Jesse, Nathan, Mike Boogie, and Chase from BB7. And so then if we're looking at who's in the older group, the people who made it the farthest in that group were Karen and Jerry. And they are the only ones who made it further than 80% of the way through. Then below that, you have Johnny, you have James, you have Bobby, you have the other Rachel from BB6, you have Jace in BB5. And then we're kind of getting to 50% and below in terms of longevity. So it's like Suzette, Kale, Levita, Paul, Cody, and Willie Hans.
Yeah, and I'm hearing those names, and it really does feel like the younger players are stacked and the older players are not the most successful players, not the best players, really. Right. I mean, I don't know if that's maybe because they tend to cast less strategically oriented players in the older half of their cast, or if it's that, you know, something else that we talk about is that, I think, you know, do you think that part of it has to do with the fact that if you're in the older half of the cast, you are more likely to be separate from the mean or the average age?
What do you mean by separate? Like, you mean they're a little bit more distant from
right,
the average
like,
age?
Like the youngest young person is, you know, like 18 or whatever, or 19, you know, which is like, you know, 9 away from 28, which I think is probably generally the average age, versus Jerry, who's like 70 years old, right?
Right.
Like there's way more of separation age-wise in that upper group.
Yeah, so that's actually what we're talking about when we mention skew. So because most of the people who are cast, more than 60%, are in their 20s, the average age is going to be closer to 20, because it doesn't matter. Like, if you have one guy in his 70s or one guy in his, 40s or whatever, like they do, you only have a handful of older people. The average age is going to be closer to around 20. And so that's kind of why... again, I kind of split it up into medians, but it's going to be very likely that most of the cast is going to be a very far age away from you.
Yeah. Well, I think that makes sense. I think that I don't know if you have this data or if you could get this, and maybe this is an entire other podcast, but I would imagine that how close you are to the median age of your cast is probably a decent indicator of your potential success in the game.
Right. Yeah. I would imagine that that's true. I don't have the data in front of me, but it would be an interesting thing to kind of look at. Yeah.
Stay tuned. but even just kind of like trying to make some kind of analysis here, that it makes sense that, you know, getting your target out requires having your finger on the pulse of the cast, requires that you, are probably surrounded with people that are willing to work with you, and you have a big group of allies. And if you are in the older age range and you are a bit more separate from the age range of the rest of the group, then you're not going to fit in as well. You're not going to immediately have those bonds and those ties. And so you're probably less likely to pick a target and get that target out that's like in a successful way. And, you know, if we want to really push the analysis here, I think older players are also probably a little more likely to be a little headstrong in their choice. Mm-hmm. Like they are more mature, they are more independent and more willing to go, no, this is what's best for my game. And they're a little bit less people pleasy than younger people, I think, in general. And so more likely to push their own agenda and have it backfire than a younger person who is more willing to go with what the house wants and have a successful HOA train.
Yeah, I agree with pretty much everything you said. I think another thing too is, not even just like talking about whether they're successful in getting their targets out, but I think generally if you have an older member of an alliance, and they're part of a group where most people are young, even if they are kind of successful in getting their target out, as that alliance moves forward, they might find themselves being one of the more disposable members of the alliance if they can't really relate to most of the people in it.
Mm-hmm. So anything else, any other bits here?
Sure. So I think one of the last main things I do want to talk about is looking at the effect of how split that first vote is. And the results are kind of not what you might expect. So when we're talking about vote split, the way I kind of measure that variable is just percentage of total votes for the first HOH's target. Right. And so just kind of looking to see whether there is an association there between percentage vote split and how long the HOH lasts in the game. So if we look at the target survived group, there isn't really much of a correlation between the extent of the vote split and how far you last. It doesn't matter if like you had a bunch of people on your side or who was totally unanimous. It's just kind of a blob of points. Like it, your longevity isn't really impacted in any meaningful way by that. Like you most of the time are not going to last halfway through the game. But if we look at the cluster of points that have to do with players who did evict their target, if you look near the top of the plot, kind of a little bit of the right to the 50% vote split line, you will see this little group of points that are very tightly clustered together. And in this cluster, you have the first HOHs who went very far in the game after being able to get their target evicted, but the vote was very split. So here we're talking like Tyler, where the first vote was 7-6, Nicole Franzel, where the vote was 7-4, Lisa Donahue, where the vote was 5-4, Rachel Riley, where the vote was 6-4. You have McCray, who wasn't a finalist, but he came up just short and his vote was 7-5. If you wanted to include Big Brother Canada, Karen would be here as well. She'd be a part of that cluster. Her vote was 7-6. And really the only outlier here is Jesse, from BB11, who you were talking about earlier, who had a 6-5 vote, but only lasted a few rounds, after his HOH expired. But Jesse is a really important outlier here to talk about because, as you were talking about before, on BB11, you'd know that his, ally Shima, who was HOH, the week he was evicted, did not nominate him. If it weren't for Jeff playing the coup d'etat and overthrowing her nominations, he survives that week and it's a completely different game. So who knows how much longer he'd end up lasting. Like, there's a chance he goes the distance and ends up in that cluster along with everybody else. So the point is that Jesse, he doesn't fall in line with the other first HOHs who had split votes, but he was evicted because of a twist and he might have found himself in that cluster if it weren't for that. This group of people who started off with a split house, but were able to evict their target anyway, have almost exclusively, like, not only made it far, but have made it to the end of the game. So then if we move to the right and look at, like, the other farther part of the scatter plot, and we look at instances where the HOH was able to get their target out, but the vote ended up being either unanimous or closer to unanimous, there's a lot more variation. So the points aren't as neatly clustered together like the split vote group. So with the exception of Hayden, who obviously he won the game and ended up with a unanimous vote the first week, the percentage of days survived range from about 90% to 48%. So you have like people like Janelle, Jerry, like Adam Pike from Big Brother Canada, who are close to being finalists. Then you have James and Christy and Caleb, Rachel, who made it all like more than halfway through the game. And then you have people like Kale, Jace from season 5, and Nathan, who didn't really last much longer than the HOHs who didn't get their targets out. So when you look at that cluster as a whole, it appears to be slightly sloping downward, or that there is a negative correlation. So there are reasons why we don't do, or we can't do, rather, a normal correlation test on this data. You can't do a test for a linear correlation, which is what a normal Pearson correlation test is. But if we were to do what's called a Spearman correlation test, which is non-parametric, you end up with a correlation coefficient or a rho of -0.47, which is a moderate correlation. If you look at the p-value there, which is basically just a measure of how statistically significant that number is, you end up seeing that you're just off from being statistically significant. But if we take Jesse's point out, which is the one outlier, because of the coup d'etat, the rho ends up being -0.63, which is very strong, and it is statistically significant. So you can be reasonably confident there that there is a negative correlation between vote split and longevity. But I'm cautious about saying that it's linear because it is more than likely not. But it's an interesting finding.
Yeah, it is. It is. And I think especially because it's a little bit counterintuitive, I think that, you know, my first thought was, well, the more unanimous the vote, then the more sort of hidden the HOH is. Their alliance is more hidden. It's more like the will of the House. You know, it feels like it would be the better play to have the entire House on board with your target. But statistically, there is some evidence to point in the other direction that actually having a split vote on your first HOH could actually be better for your game.
Yeah, definitely. My personal theory was that, like, in a case of a split vote, the HOH has like a very solid alliance backing them, and this alliance is probably willing to draw a line in the sand during a time early on where people usually aren't willing to stick their neck out and make a big move. I think people would prefer to just hide behind whatever the House is doing. But if they are willing to, like I said, stick their neck out and basically tell the other side of the House, like, I am against you, but with just the way they were voting, that's probably good for you. Whereas in the case of a unanimous vote, the House dynamics might still be fluid because, like, nobody's explicitly had to betray each other. Like, you might hear this talked a lot about on Survivor, where they say the reasons, like, the Tandangs and the Calabas of the world, like, tend to fall apart after the merge is that they never went to tribal council, so they never had an opportunity to show their allies that they were with them. So I would assume it's a similar idea that's happening here.
Yeah, and, you know, thinking about it, I wonder too if part of it comes down to the idea that you know, this is not just a game of getting your alliance to the end, but also getting yourself to the end. And if, like, it might be better for your alliance if the vote is hidden as a whole, but if your alliance if the people have to actually stick their necks out and place their vote down, and it's a split vote, then it feels like there's more targets to go around, right? If you are on the wrong side of that vote, then, you know, well, these six people, these seven people, whoever it is, they're the ones that voted against this vote. And there's more blame to pass around. Whereas if the entire House gets behind it, then everybody gets to kind of hide and you're the only one standing out as HOH.
Yeah, no, definitely. That's a really good point. And I think too, like, once you vote against a certain portion of the House, like, you're committed, like, that's it. Yeah. You've basically told them where you stand, and it's a lot harder to backpedal from that.
Yeah. So interesting stuff. It may be a fruitless exercise. We may be trying to milk something from nothing, but I think there are some interesting conclusions here.
Yeah, no, definitely. I agree. It's a really interesting question.
Yeah. Now we are going to take a quick break for our sponsors, and we'll be right back.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
And we're back. So let's get back to the show. So I really like going into this from my own perspective, you know, and heading into this, I queued up a couple things before we got into the data that I was going to be looking out for. And I really think the thing that stood out to me the most, when I was looking into first HOA trends, just to clarify, like, going in, I felt like winning the first HOH, generally a good thing. I still feel that way. And I think the two major things that stood out to me were, the target thing. Did they get their target out? Were they on the right side of the vote? And then the second thing that stood out to me was pretty much every single person who won the first HOH is included in some kind of alliance. It's usually a decent sized alliance. I think the smallest alliance is probably like four people. And I'm not like 100% sure what Big Brother 6 Rachel was up to in her first HOH. But apart from that, like pretty much every single person, and again, Big Brother 9, not counting, but pretty much every single person is in some kind of alliance. And many of them are majority alliances, or at least plurality alliances, I guess you'd call them the biggest alliance in the house. And many of them are successful alliances where somebody from that alliance ends up winning the game. And so just getting your ticket inside of that alliance itself, I feel like is worth it to be there, to have a basically have a guaranteed slot in a group of people who are probably the biggest group of people and will probably find some decent success in the game. I feel like is very valuable. And so when Christina is looking at this data and saying that getting your target out in your first week successfully is a huge indicator of your overall success in the game. It feels like that could easily tie into this alliance idea, right? Being HOH gets you into an alliance, and the success of that alliance, the best indicator of success for that alliance is, did that alliance successfully take out a target in the first week? If they didn't, then it's probably an alliance doomed to fail, and that's about it. But if you did, then your alliance is on a good footing moving forward and can probably do well. I mean, you can, like, even looking at Christy, who's in a majority alliance as the first HOH, and manages to successfully take out a target. It wasn't exactly like the most strategic target in the world, yeah. But it doesn't have to be a strategic target. It just has to be that you weren't wrong. You didn't fail. That's the only criteria. And you can say that, like, you know, Grateful, which was that alliance, ends up breaking up, ends up failing, but somebody from Grateful does end up winning the game. And Christy certainly makes it pretty decently far. And, you know, Grateful, whether it succeeds or fails, helps most of the members of the alliance, get decently far in the game. And so I especially noticed this, like, you know, from in the teens, right? Like, once you get into like the modern seasons of the show, where, you know, if you go back to my alliance structure podcast, if you listen to that, then you know that I talked about the development of alliance structure and how, especially, you know, when Big Brother 10, Big Brother 12, when these seasons hit, alliances start becoming more important because they've developed to a point that they're actually very successful if implemented well. And if not implemented well, they can still be kind of successful because of how dominant the strategy is. And so I think that winning the first HOH becomes even more important. And you see, starting from Big Brother 12, Hayden wins the game. Rachel wins the game. Nicole wins the game. You start to see these people who, based on alliances that they got into in their first week, end up making it very far, winning the game. Nicole is probably the least successful in terms of the alliance she made at the start, making it far. But she still, of course, is going to get there and win the game. And so I feel like these two things can come together. And again, now this is, we're not in the data portion anymore. This is me just making connections, like a conspiracy theorist. But it feels like the most important thing, that if you win the first HOH, it means you're in that alliance. If that alliance is a good one and it's going to be successful, it means you have taken out, it means you're going to be successful in the first week. And so if you win that first HOH, you're in alliance, you successfully take out a target, you're in a pretty good spot. You can feel pretty comfortable about, like, I really feel good about this. I'm in a spot where statistically people have done really well.
Yeah, no, for sure. I agree with all of that. Like, I think we hear Rob talk about a lot that, like, on Survivor and Big Brother, the biggest, most cohesive group will always win out. And you really do see that play out in the data with, like, people like Hayden, who had the Brigade backing him, people like Tyler, who had level 6 backing them, those kinds of people who really use their first HOHs to build strong, long-lasting relationships really do succeed the most.
Yeah, and then I think another takeaway that we can get from your data, like, so something that I had thought of prior to your data was that winning the HOH, the first one, and setting up the alliance, it can help in sort of two different ways in terms of your positioning. Within your alliance, you have more of a say in terms of like who you bring in, how the alliance looks, how it's structured. You have more control over that because you're the one in power that week. And so when you're going to people and saying, hey, I want to work with you, or people are coming to you and saying, hey, I want to work with you. If you're not the HOH, you're kind of in a position where you have to take what you can get. Like, okay, we're bringing you into this group of five. You're the number six. Great job. If you're the HOH, then you can, if you want, be like, hey, I want to work with these people. And people mostly have to say yes, because they don't want to be nominated. And they want you on their team because they want to help control the first week and they want to be safe in the first week. And so overall, you just have more say over the construction of that first group, which puts you in a better position as long as you know what to do. In terms of structuring and everything, it puts you in a position where you're better situated and better positioned. And then also, it can help you with the other side of the house because you're structuring your own group and you're choosing targets, you can have a good relationship with the other side of the house as well. I'm thinking of somebody like Nathan in Big Brother 4, who is in a group of eight. They're the first eight into the house. They're the people who aren't the exes. Nathan wins the first HOH. He puts up two exes, but he also makes a deal with the other exes. Hey, I'm not going to put you up. He follows through on that deal. And so he pleases his alliance by taking out one of the exes and also pleases the remaining exes by following through on a deal with them. And so he's able to maintain better relationships with those other people not in his alliance than many of the people within his alliance. He's going to go ahead and screw that up when he uses the veto on Ali later, but it put him in a position to be in a better spot overall. And so that was my thought prior to the data. And then I think that this stuff about, you know, split votes helps. If we can interpret it in the way that we were talking about earlier, it can actually sort of help with this idea, which is that when you are the HOH and you have an alliance or a group of people that you're working with and they all vote a certain way and the other side of the house votes a different way, then that helps again put you in a position of power and in a position to last longer than some of your other alliance members, because they're the ones sticking their necks out last, if that makes sense. Like, so yeah. When you're HOH, you put two targets on the block, you can be like, I don't know what to do. But when it comes down to the vote, that's when people have already strategized and the lines have been drawn and those people are casting those votes and they're drawing the line and you're just the guy that just stood there. And a great example of this is Tyler, who was one of the best first HOHs, as far as I'm concerned, who was able to really play the middle and make all of his alliance members put their necks on the line and cast votes against the rest of the other group. And he was able to sit back and let the two sides go at each other, even though he was the one that set it up in the first place. And so I think that that's another angle of where how being first HOH helps you not only get in the alliance, but also position yourself well, both in the alliance and in the house at large.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. I totally agree with all of that. Like, I think, it's, if you, again, using your example of Tyler, like the Faute Alliance, like who were they mad at going forward? They weren't mad at Tyler, who ultimately was the one who put those two people on the block. Like they were mad at Brett. They were mad at Winston. They were mad at Angela, who were the ones who were the ones who actually had to cast those votes. So, it's definitely a good way to kind of have less blood on your hands than the rest of the house, even when you're the one saying who is eligible to go home.
Yeah. But I do still think there are some cons and some pitfalls to being the first HOH. Winning anything is always going to put a target on your back. Being the first person to win, I think, it's a dangerous spot to be in, because in the house, there are two different ways that people determine competition threat. right? Or there's sort of like imagined threat that usually comes from this person's very physical, or they're very big, or they're, you know, do you see them doing Spider-Man push-ups, or do you see them, you know, do you see, are they super physical, or are they like super good at puzzles? Like, are they really smart? Do they win at pool every single time? Whatever it is, like there's that sort of imagined, I think they will be good at competitions. And then there's the even more concrete version of it, which is I've seen them do well at competitions. It's the sort of like this person has won 3 competitions, like they are a massive threat to win competitions. And so the combination of those two, I think overall will come together and determine your overall competition threat level. And so by winning the first HOH, you are immediately adding to that threat level. And if you are also somebody who is like muscular or very fit, or otherwise would be perceived as being a threat, then you're probably just adding on top of something that people are already worried about. And so that can be, it can be risky. But I think overall, it's worth the risk. And I think that, you know, when we look at, you know, the players that have won, I wonder if, you know, we look at Lisa, who won basically a popularity contest, was the first HOH that she won. We look at, and she wasn't really targeted for being a competition threat because of it. But then if we look at like, you know, Rachel, who won the first HOH and then also won the veto, in the game that she won, the game, you know, she was targeted for being a threat basically the whole game. But she also won a lot of competitions and managed to win her way there anyway. So, you know, I think it can go either way, but a lot of times if you're somebody like Rachel, you already have a target on your back for being a comp threat. You might as well win the competitions. If you're somebody like Lisa and you aren't likely to be targeted for being a competition threat, and it's a popularity contest, that can make you threatening in other ways. But it didn't really make her a competition threat. It didn't make people worried that she was going to win a bunch of things and get them out. And so, you know, it can be, I think, a case by case basis. And overall, I think that the target being put on your back is not going to be too bad for you.
Right. Yeah, I agree. And I think, you know, Big Brother is a social game at the end of the day. And we have seen players who are massive challenge beasts, you know, Tyler, Adam, you know, people like that who just look the part, get really far just on the laurels of their social relationships. So I think even if you do find yourself being a big physical threat, or just a mental threat in terms of the challenges, if you have the foundation of good social relationships, it really shouldn't impact you that much.
Yeah. And so then I think the other risk being the first HOH is that, on it, like if you're not a very capable player and you don't succeed in taking out your target, that's basically a death sentence. Like, like you're basically screwed, right? So, like if you're not good at the game, you know, don't win the first HOH. But yeah, if you're not good at the game, you're also probably not going to do well anyway. I think I really can't think of many other cons, and I don't think these cons are very conny. So I really feel like, you know, people should be gunning for the first HOH.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's a really good opportunity to just set yourself up for the rest of the game.
Yes. So I had another question, which was, should you also win the veto? Because I generally advise that if you win the first HOH, you probably shouldn't also win the first veto, because then you're really hammering home. Like, yeah, I just competed against the whole house twice, essentially 6 people the second time, and I won twice. You're the only person that's won any competition in the first up to like 14 days of the game. It's really going to start to seem like you are the person to beat for the whole game. So the people that did win the first HOH and the first veto, you have Rachel, who was a big target all season long, and was basically forced to win out with her alliance. She was only vulnerable for a couple of rounds that season, and those rounds had other people that were a little bit more pressing. So I guess in that regard, it didn't hurt her that much, but she was definitely considered to be a big target. Then you have Janelle, who won a co-HOH and the first veto of All-Stars and was definitely a big target all season long. Also had to basically win out to get herself as far as she did. But she did manage to have some allies that helped her out along the way. But they kind of used her as a target in front of them. Then you had, the other Rachel, Big Brother 6 Rachel, who again, definitely did have a target on her back. If not for, you know, Kacer making the move against Eric, she might have been targeted, the first time that, the Sovereign 6 had the opportunity after Eric goes. But she was targeted the second time. And then again, like, she then won a veto again, and she was targeted again and finally left. So she definitely paid for the target on her back by winning that first HOH and veto. Then you have, Johnny from Big Brother Canada, who was a great player and did a lot of great things in the game, but never really shook that competition threat status off of his back after winning the first HOH and veto. Now he also is going to go on to win more competitions to continue to, reinforce that idea. And maybe if he hadn't, he'd been okay. He would have been okay. But who knows? There's also McCray, who won the first HOH and the first veto, then didn't win another thing until week 10. And I think that was the way to go, that he was able to set himself up to a point where he didn't need to win anything else for another 9 weeks. And that prevented him from being targeted as a massive competition threat. He also doesn't look like a big competition threat, right? And I think that helps as well.
Yeah, no, definitely. It's an interesting question. I actually kind of had trouble with this just because, it's again, very small sample size. There are only, if we're looking at just BBUS, like you said, there are only four people who have won. So if you do the math, people who won the veto, after winning the first HOH, if you look at the proportion of total days lasted, those people have lasted about 86% of the days, following the completion of their HOH. So from like the point that they were vulnerable, they lasted 86% of the days. And then if you look at the HOHs who haven't won the veto, they've lasted about 60% of the days. But again, like I said, there have only been four, very small sample size. It's really hard to draw any meaningful conclusions from that. And I think that difference might be coming from the fact that all four of those veto winners were able to get their target out. So rather than having that difference be due to winning the veto itself, I think it's mainly due to the fact that they were successful in evicting their targets. But yeah, it's really hard to say with the sample we have.
Yeah. And it's also, I think, I think it's going to be hard to see because people that won the HOH and veto are also probably a lot more likely to be very good at competitions. And if you're very good at competitions, you're on the strength of that alone, probably going to make it further than your average contestant. And I think that's exactly what's happening with Janelle and Rachel, where, they won HOH and veto, were big targets because of it. But they won so often that people couldn't get them out. So they were, I think, harmed by it in some way, but they were also it's an indication that they were also good enough at competitions to win their way out of it. And so it's going to be hard to quantify where this all comes from, with this one. But I think overall, I think if we're going to try to take a conclusion from this and try to, answer the question, should you win the veto if you won the first HOH? The answer is probably if you need to win the veto to take out your target, then you probably should. It's probably, probably worth it to take the risk and make sure that your target goes home if you're concerned that it's not going to happen. If you are capable of taking out your target without winning the veto, and I think that somebody that we should look at here is Tyler. Tyler, who was capable of winning the veto, basically chose not to because he didn't want to put the target on his back and was able to take out his target without winning the veto. That's probably the best case scenario, where it means that Tyler's very good at competitions, but doesn't put a big target on his back by winning both, and is still able to take out his target. I think that's the ideal. But if you need to win the veto to take out your target, you probably should. Although if you needed to win the veto to take out your target, you're also probably not in a good position. Like if taking out your target is meant as an indicator of your good placement in the game, then getting your target out is probably not going to magically make your placement better in the game. Take that with a grain of salt as well.
Right. Yeah. Like ideally you'd be using the days before the veto competition to kind of put a plan in place. I agree with that.
I think at the end of the day, right, you should try to win the first HOH, and your game plan should be you win, you use the power and influence granted to you by the powers of HOH to gather as much information as possible and then structure the house in your favor with that. You can't be, Caleb and Devin in Big Brother 16 and like ordering people around. But at the same time, like, Caleb did make it far. If you need to force people together, it's, I think, still good to have people with you. Being in a majority alliance is just so huge for you, regardless of the circumstances around it, that it's worth doing everything you can to make sure you're in one, which includes winning the first HOH. But you having HOH allows you to obtain information. It allows you to get to know people better, have more social relationships than basically anybody else in the house, because people have to talk to you. And with that information, you can pick and choose the people that you think will combine in the best way for your game. And then you can, decide to nominate people that that will work for you. So make sure that you have some kind of majority or plurality alliance. I don't know what the best way to call it. And then make sure that you aren't like dictating at them, take input from them, make sure it's kind of a group decision, but also make sure that it's, it works out for you. Don't take big swings, in my opinion. Don't put yourself in a position where there's a success or failure state in your HOH. You should put two people on the block where if the tide goes either way, you're good. Because if you put yourself in a position where you can't fail to get out your target because there are two targets on the block, then you're not going to have to worry about failing, right? Then you only have to worry about people blindsiding you for the sake of blindsiding you, which is really bad. And then, it just means you're really bad at the game. I think in general, don't fall into this idea of like, I'm going to take a big swing for the sake of my alliance. No, put two people up that aren't very connected in the house, that nobody's going to be very upset if they get put up. They don't have a lot of power in the game to come and, take a shot back at you. And then be okay with either of them leaving. Don't push too hard in the vote either. I think as long as two people are on the block that you don't mind, let your alliance kind of like figure it out. Do whatever they want to do. Certainly get to know the people on the block. If you do find that you have a preference, you can start to push, but I don't put your neck out on the line and put yourself in a position where you have a failure state. Just make sure that you're okay either way. Make sure that, again, you're using your status as HOH to make sure that you understand where the house lies and where the votes are falling. I think that if you are able to figure out where the votes fall, or are going to fall, then you can use your status as HOH to go to the person that you expect to stay in the game and kind of like imply to them that like you've given it the thumbs up, that like you want them to stay, because even if you didn't have much to do with it, you can kind of get some credit from it if they stay, as long as you're not too obvious about trying to take credit from it. I think that's pretty much how you should operate here. Don't do anything to make your allies or the house at large feel uncomfortable. Don't look like a wild card. Don't make it seem like you're willing to change your plan at the drop of a dime, or that you're going to change your mind, or that if somebody pisses you off, then you're immediately going to just start to want to target them. Be a steady presence, be a reliable presence. That's what really, I think, makes people feel like, okay, when they were in power, I felt good. And so that impression, that feeling is going to last for a while in people, I think. And it's going to make them unconsciously want you to be in power again and want you to be in the House because you were able to make them feel safe. And that's powerful in the game. So that's a good one. And I think overall, like if you do all of those things, most of those things, then you're probably in a really good position moving forward in the game to make it really far.
Yeah, no, totally. You summed it up really, really well.
All right. So that's the first HOH. Hopefully, you know, again, this is kind of, we're still experimenting. We're doing all kinds of different things with this podcast. I hope you guys like this one. I found it super informative. This is something that I've thought about a lot, beforehand. And I feel like, some of this data stuff actually did make me think even deeper about it. So hopefully everybody found this useful.
Yeah, hopefully. I mean, obviously, I do data analysis for work. But this kind of stuff, as big of a reality TV fan as I am, like, it doesn't feel like work looking into this stuff. It's really interesting.
Awesome. So where can people find you, Christina, if they want to thank you for your excellent work?
Sure. You can find me on Twitter at Christina Zack, C-H-R-I-S-T-I-N-A-Z-A-C-C underscore. Hopefully, if we're able to safely have a Big Brother season this year, if you follow me, you can expect the spamming of your feeds with a lot of Stockwatch content. So you have that to look forward to.
Yes. And you can, of course, find me on Twitter at Armstrong Taren and on Twitch, twitch.tv/Taren Armstrong. Hopefully you guys enjoyed this. I will be back next week with some more off season content as we continue to wonder what's going to happen this summer, whether it's going to be All Stars, whether it's going to be anything. Who knows? But I'm sure we're going to have a lot to talk about either way. So thank you guys for joining us, and I will see you next time.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.